You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage, and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Howdy out there. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel for the 129th episode of your Rock Art Podcast. Today we have guest scholar Dr. Richard Chacon, who has just published a remarkable book on supernatural gamekeepers throughout the world. And we're going to talk about how that relates to rock art and other related matters in terms of the pre-contact, pre-literate indigenous cosmology. You don't want to miss this. This is a first-hand exposition of shamanism. So, Rick, are you there?
I'm here.
Great. So, Rick, tell me a bit about the book and exactly what is a supernatural gamekeeper.
Yeah, that's a good place to start. The concept of a supernatural gamekeeper is widespread. There's evidence of it from the ancient peoples of Britain down to Mesopotamia, through Siberia, the Ainu of Japan, and throughout the Americas. And it's this notion that, and it's again common among foraging peoples, it's this notion that there's a supernatural being that grants hunting success to an individual as long as that individual follows certain rules. And the rules usually are take only what you need. In other words, don't kill just for the sake of killing, but take only what you need and show respect to the animal. And usually right. That respect involves a proper treatment of the carcass, you know, disposing of the bones properly and so, but that's it in a nutshell, that hunting success, and this is really important, hunting success is absolutely dependent on whether or not a hunter maintains a good relationship with the supernatural gamekeeper. So that's key, and that's all over the world, except for Australia. That's the only place where we have not found it. But other than that, it's ubiquitous.
So how did this project start vis-a-vis the supernatural gamekeeper as a theme, and why supernatural gamekeepers? Why was that selected by you as a theme and a focus for this book?
That's a great question, because I did my dissertation among the blowgun hunting Achuar of the Ecuadorian Amazon, and my research was basically testing optimal foraging theory. And optimal foraging theory is very quantitative. Very, very quantitative. So I'm out there in the field with my scales so that I can weigh what the hunters are, you know, harvesting, and my watch so that I know, you know, how long they're out there, so I can, you know, calculate kilograms per hour of hunting returns. All very scientific, all very quantitative. But I realized early on that all kinds of non-caloric, non-energetic factors were being taken into consideration when deciding what to hunt and when to hunt and how much to hunt. Things like, for example, if a hunter's wife is about to give birth, that shifts a whole prey choice. They forego harvesting all kinds of animals. And that flies in the face of optimal foraging theory. Also dreams. Dreams affect hunting or foraging decisions big time. And so I realized that if I am going to understand hunting, I have to dive into their beliefs. Now, don't get me wrong. Optimal foraging theory still, in my opinion, is the best predictor of prey choice. Absolutely. But there are some really important exceptions. And to understand those exceptions, you got to delve into their beliefs. So I kind of stumbled upon this notion of beliefs affecting foraging decisions. I hope that made sense.
Yeah, no, it does very much. Give us a glimpse of the contributors, perhaps, and the geography and the subject matter encompassed in the Supernatural Gamekeeper volume.
Well, you know, before I do that, let me back up and then I'll explain why I selected.
Please, please. Yeah, give them background.
All right. I was out in the forest with my closest friend, a guy named Kaisar, who's a blowgun hunter. And he starts talking about how he mentioned this supernatural being called Amasan. Amasan. And he said, Amasan is the owner of meat. His words, the owner of meat, the owner of all wild game. Oh, tell me more. And so he explained that. Amasan is a supernatural being who roams throughout the forest with a magical blowgun. And when first of all, he said, Amasan loves us being the Achuar. Amasan loves the Achuar. And he sees how we suffer. And that's important to understand because this is not sport hunting. This is subsistence hunting. It's very grueling and it is very dangerous. So it's not playing games. It's not sport hunting. So he loves us, he sees how we suffer, and he takes pity on us. And if we have lived by his rules, his rules are take only what you need and be respectful of the game, then he, with his magical blowgun, will shoot at an animal. And it's a magical blowgun, so he never misses. And then that will allow the hunter to bag an animal. And so, I thought, oh, what a interesting myth. So I dutifully record it and put it away. And then a couple of years later, I find versions of the exact same myth, say in a neighboring Amazonian group. I thought, okay, that's interesting. But then I find really similar versions among North American groups and groups in the Arctic and then the Ainu and then Siberia. And it just snowballed. And I go, oh my gosh, this is all over the world. And then I thought, okay, as far as I know, anthropologists have dutifully recorded versions of this myth and this belief wherever they encounter it, but there's been relatively little attempts at bringing them all together and trying to make sense out of them, except for two. There's just two examples. A guy named Hulkrantz that I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yes.
In 1961, he did it in Sweden, actually brought together specialists from North America and from Europe, and had sort of like a little mini symposium, and he presented their papers of the variations of the supernatural gamekeeper. And so it was a start, but it was very small in number, and there was no attempt to test any theory or to make sense out of it. But there was a massive work done by Slotin in 1966, dissertation. It is a tour de force. This guy just compiled example after example of belief in supernatural gamekeepers from every continent except Australia and Antarctica. And it's a wonderful source, but it's marred by the fact that he is looking at the data through the lens of culture circle theory, which is very problematic. But those two were pretty much it as far as compiling examples. So I said, okay, no, I'm going to really look for people that are top-notch and representative of the world, and I got them. And of course, you are among the group that took my invitation, and I'm very grateful to you. So it was key that we had a group that's at least a representative case from every continent, again, except Australia and Antarctica.
Well, one of the themes of in terms of my reading and understanding of my own work came from reading ethnographies that talk about the relationship of the shamans and the use of, psychoactive substances, and also their depictions, their renditions of this being, and also relating to rock art. Does this show up anywhere in your work?
Well, that's another reason why I decided to take this on, and I invited you in particular, is that, rock art's all over the world, and there's a lot of guessing as to trying to figure out what does this rock art mean. But in this volume, the people that I invited that dealt with rock art were people that had really solid, solid ethnographic data linking that rock art with supernatural gamekeepers. And that's why I invited you to talk about your group that's in the Tehachapi, the Kaiwaisu. And then I also invited David Dye that talks about the Southeast. And there's this massive boulder in North Carolina that was in Cherokee territory. It's called Huda Kula Rock. It's massive. And there's it's where the supernatural gamekeeper called Huda Kula stepped on it. And you can see his feet sort of in the steatite. And so the chapters that have rock art in the volume, they have absolutely unequivocal ties to supernatural gamekeeper. Oh, and there's one more, the famous Tucano of Colombia, in which there's a panel in a river. There's a panel that the Indians say that's where the master of fish lives. And this is not our interpretation. That's what the Indians themselves say. So it's really important that we included examples of rock art with absolutely irrefutable evidence that those designs on the rock art have to do with supernatural gamekeeper.
Which is rather amazing. And that kind of association sort of goes against some of the alternative explanations for the function and meaning and, you know, how to best understand rock art, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, you and I have had lengthy discussions about this, and rock art can have more than one function, and we're not saying that all rock art has to do with supernatural gamekeepers. That would be absurd. You know, rock art obviously can be used by shamans for puberty rites and vision quests, and we're certainly not denying that. One thing that's really important that I want to acknowledge from the get-go is that just because a rock art panel has an image of an animal, it would be ridiculous to assume that animal image has something to do with hunting magic. That would be absurd. Just because there's an animal symbol, it could be there for all kinds of reasons, from, you know, puberty rites to rain magic, and, you know, it could be all over the place. So we have to be very careful, just because there's an animal depicted in a rock art, not to have this knee-jerk reaction or knee-jerk interpretation that it has something to do with hunting magic. But the cases that we included, as I said, the Tucano of Colombia, the Kaiwaisu of California, and the Cherokee, Huda Kula, there's no doubt, and that's not some anthropologist's spin or interpretation. The native peoples themselves say it's all about the supernatural gamekeeper. So that's why I feel really, really good about the rock art, the chapters associated with rock art in the book.
How does the supernatural gamekeeper integrate with the overarching cosmology of preliterate people, of foraging people? How does that work? Where does that particular deity or super mundane being fit in all of that? And what sort of ceremonies or other activities are directly or indirectly related to that individual?
Oh, I love that question. Well, for example, among the Tucano and among the Lake Atitlan Maya and among the Emberá of Colombia, if you're a hunter, you have to go through the shaman. So the answer is all of these things are related, and the shamans play a critical role in serving as intermediaries between the hunter and the supernatural gamekeeper.
Help me understand again who the shaman is and how that articulates, because you're saying something very, very important about the shaman and their role.
The shaman plays among those groups that I mentioned, Lake Atitlan Maya, the Emberá of Colombia, the Tucano also of Colombia. You don't just wake up one day and decide to go hunting. You have to go through all kinds of, you as a hunter, you have to ritually purify, engage in sexual abstinence, and then you go to the shaman and you say, I wish to hunt, and then he will perform all kinds of rituals. Among the Emberá, he'll chant with a bunch of staffs, sort of magical staffs. But the point is, you lay your request upon the shaman. Among the Lake Atitlan Maya, you and the shaman and your hunting dog will go to a shrine where the supernatural gamekeeper resides, and the shaman then will present your petition for you. And then the shaman will receive feedback by way of a dream or an intuition, And for example, let's say you're in Lake Atitlan subsistence hunter, and then the shaman will say, okay, only one red deer for you. Your neighbor may be more fortunate in a dream. That neighbor may be allotted two deer. Okay, great. So then you take off and you hunt. But among the Lake Atitlan Maya, you curate the bones. You save the bones, and then you bring them back to the sanctuary of the supernatural gamekeeper. And of course, and you do this by way of the shaman. And the shaman then presents the bones from the animal that you killed. And again, you always stay within your quota to prove to the supernatural gamekeeper that you have behaved properly, that you have not taken more than what you were allotted, and all is well. So the point is, in some of these folks, some of these people, the shamans play and roles as intermediaries for hunting. Now, not all, but many do.
And so the intermediary, of course, is an intermediary between the cosmic or celestial super mundane beings,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and the terrestrial commoners. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the shaman has the ability to sort of bridge those worlds. Am I correct?
Yes. And shamans have great, great influence. For example, among the Achuar and among just about every group in the Americas, shamans are believed to have the ability to hide wildlife. And in fact, scarcity, I've documented over-harvesting of natural resources. By that, I mean certain species of game in the Amazon, and it's due to overhunting. When I ask the Achuar, why is it that in almost a decade of doing research in this village, I've never seen you guys take a tapir, I've never seen you guys harvest a spider monkey, I've never seen you folks harvest a white-lipped peccary. And by the way, all of those are indicator species. You know, they're the first ones to go when an area is depleted. By the way, you see lots of sign of those animals that I just mentioned when yeah. you're about 14, 15 kilometers away from the village.
Right, right.
But nothing close to the village. When I asked them why is it, they don't say overhunting. They say sorcery.
Malevolent sorcery.
Shape, hide. They wish to do us harm.
Let me stop there and let's pick up that discussion in the next segment. See you in the flip-flop, gang. Welcome back, gang. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel, your host for today with Dr. Rick Chacon, and we're talking about supernatural gamekeepers. That's the central topic of a new book. Rick, when we were on the first segment, we were talking about the issue of the shaman hiding, mm-hmm. perhaps, the animals from our hunters. Could you please explain that a little bit more in detail?
Yes, this is when I asked the Achuar of Alto Corrientes, the village that I do work, did my dissertation in, and these are subsistence hunters. These are people that they're not involved in the bush for meat trade. They're trying to feed their families. When I asked them to explain why is that certain species are just nowhere to be found close to the village, they say sorcery, evil sorcerers. They hide animals. They hide the
wolves. They hide animals. Okay.
They hide animals. They wish to hurt us. And then I could just imagine the look on my face. And he says, and my closest friend, Kaisar, he's the one who told me about Amasan in the first place, explained it to me using terms and examples that I could understand. And he said, you know how whites or mestizos can move cattle from one corral to another at will? I said, yeah, so it is with shamans. By way of a certain chant, they can move wildlife, toucans, monkeys, peccaries, from one area to another, just by way of magical chants, to harm people with the same ease. And he added, and they hide animals underground, physically underground. And there underground, they're fed by the huri huri spirits that are sort of at the beck and call of Amasan. So, and then they're put in the ground and they're covered with vegetation and a termite nest. So game scarcity is never explained by overhunting. It's always attributed to either sorcery or to some hunter breaking the rules, the proper protocols of how to navigate that were set by Amasan. It is never, traditionally, it is never due to overhunting. In fact, native peoples, and this has been recorded by Emery and Brown, as well as David Dye, myself, and several other people. Shep Crick also documented this, that traditionally, Native peoples did not think that hunting had of any effect at all at local wildlife populations. In fact, the Lake Atitlan Maya laughed at Kitty Emery and Linda Brown when they suggested that they were overhunting local deer. They said,
"Yeah, it couldn't happen. It was impossible."
They found that
ridiculous. Laughing. Yeah. Now let me ask one related question: is the cosmological realm of these indigenous in South America, do they have the belief that these animals are, in essence, immortal, that their souls go to these supernatural gamekeepers and then they're refurbished or transmogrified and appear again, emanating out of portals? Is that true or untrue?
That is such another juicy topic. Well, this is why, like, for example, in the salmon in the north, it's so important to treat the salmon bones with great respect. And it depends on the group, too. Salmon bones need to be put in the river, and there they will be supernaturally regenerated.
Yes.
So it depends on the tribe. But in many cases, the animals will automatically regenerate as long as everything is done properly.
I see.
Among the Cree, that belief is so strong that I think Brightman is his name who recorded this among the Boreal Forest Cree of Canada. The quote was, not only did these folks believe that hunting had no effect on wildlife, but they believe that the more you kill, the more animals will be available.
Wow. Wow.
As long as you follow that proper protocol.
The more you kill, there'll be more animals.
And that's not a spin on some anthropologist, and that's not my claim. That's Brightman.
No, that's right.
In my article, in my chapter, I even can cite the quote, and that's something that was said to him, to his face. And this is critical. This is critical, especially when it comes time to trying to help Native groups deal with the onslaught of the Western world, because they're going to get hit. They are getting hit really hard. And one of the first things that stresses them out is food shortages.
Of course.
And if they're operating with this belief system in that hunting has no effect on local wildlife, they're ill-equipped to deal with the food shortages. That is, if they remain as subsistence hunters.
Right. So that would sort of contradict, you know, you would have a significant resource depression, as it's called, if you were over hunting, or if you sort of affected the demography of the animals, correct?
Well, yeah, it will hamper their ability to deal with food shortage if they believe that hunting has no effect on wildlife. They just, you know, keep hunting.
Right.
And this is of critical, critical importance.
But also anthropologists and archaeologists, for that matter, for the longest time, thought that, you know, the preliterate societies foraging would certainly be unable to affect the demographics of animals.
Yeah.
And when I kind of naively thought about that with bighorn, I said, how could they possibly have affected, you know, the numbers and character, the demographics on such an animal?
Well, the archaeological data and ethnographic studies have shown, and Craig has shown this, and my research has shown this,
yes,
that Native peoples using traditional technology are very capable of impacting the environment and transforming landscapes, and in some cases, not always, causing environmental degradation. That's not always the case, but don't be surprised when it does happen. But among the Achuar, I was very concerned about what I saw. You know, certain species are becoming depleted, but not all. Other species are apparently being taken at rates that are sustainable. And things like agoutis, which are like jungle rodents. And I'm not the first one to notice that. Other people like Alvard have shown that. And it's because certain jungle rodents are attracted to gardens. So you might, as a matter of fact, you might find certain jungle rodents at higher densities near a population than out in the pristine forest, quote unquote. But here's what I'm so concerned about. Say like a group like the Achuar. Prior to pacification, there used to be quite a lot of warfare in this area, the Pastaza province of Ecuador. Prior to pacification, obviously during war, people die. And prior to pacification, you don't have, say, the Western presence of medical doctors. Once the Achuar were pacified, warfare was completely stopped, then life expectancy goes up. They have better access to medicine. Infant mortality goes down. So that means there's more Achuar. That's something that I
right, right.
Happy. I'm happy. But the problem is the land base of the Achuar is not expanding while the population is. And the Achuar are still operating with this mindset that what determines the outcome of hunts is a good relationship with Amasan. And so this is very problematic. Now, in the old days, when they would deplete an area, they simply moved to a non-hunted area, to a, you know, to an unoccupied area. That's how they would solve that problem in the past. That's no longer feasible because the government of Ecuador has granted title to the local watershed for each group, and that's good. They can no longer be run off the land.
And there's more people.
But yeah, there's more people, and they're no longer free to pick up and move and start
right.
over again.
Right.
So they find themselves in a situation that they've never been in before. Now they have to figure out what do they do in light of declining hunting returns.
Right.
And the old explanation that served them fine in the past is not conducive to dealing with this in a healthy way, because the belief is hunting has no effect on wildlife populations, and that can
right.
really get into trouble.
So would they not do what's called prey switching? Would they not go to smaller
yes,
game
exactly.
animals?
Oh my gosh, that's fantastic. I did a comparative study from the village, you know, your typical village hunt. Are your quintessential central place foragers. You know, they live in the
okay.
place, and every day they go out and hunt. Probably, I would say, they never hunt more than 10 kilometers away from the village.
Okay.
Maybe 12 or so. Then they come back. And they do this every day. And so it goes without saying that within that sphere, you're not getting those higher-ranked prey items like tapirs and lots of monkeys and all that. They switch to lower-ranked, less desirable prey when they're in the village. Why? It's because the really higher rank, more desirable prey have been hunted out.
Yeah.
But the Achuar, this is really interesting with the Achuar, when they have a big festival, they invite other villages to come and spend like a week with them. And you don't want to run out of food when you're hosting a village. That would be really embarrassing. So they will have an extended hunt. They move way, way out in it's usually 13 kilometers away from the village. I know because I had GPS fixes on these
sure.
hunting. So they go 13 kilometers away from their village, and that will put them into a non-hunted, non-depleted areas. And that's when you see a switch in prey choice in that.
Then they can get bigger game.
Yeah, then they get those higher-ranked prey items, as predicted by optimal foraging theory. And they'll might take some smaller animals, but they are preferentially targeting those larger prey species. And they know it. They say, that's why we go out there, because there's lots of woolly monkeys and delicious animals. I'm getting hungry just thinking about them.
Now, I remember that there was some articles written, and you've alluded to the fact that there are either shrines or shelters in which they preferentially curate the bones Ooh. Of the hunted animals. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, that's the Lake Atitlan Maya, and that's work that Emery and Brown have done. And I just hats off to them. I have nothing but admiration for them. But there are these rock outcrops among the Lake Atitlan Maya. And there the hunters are really into deer. These are deer to be consumed, not to be sold on the bush trade. And as I said, if you and I are Lake Atitlan Maya hunters and we want to kill a deer, we don't just wake up one day and decide to go hunting, but we go and we ask the shaman. And then, you know, the shaman walks you through that ritual that I just mentioned before.
Right.
And even your hunting dog has to attend.
There you go.
The purification rituals and all that. So you get a quota. Fine. Let's say you were allocated 2 deer. I got allocated 3. Fine. So we kill our animal and we treat the bones with respect. But then we guard the bones. We hang on to the bones, and then we return the bones and all of your bones. I forget how many you were allocated. 3. Anyway, so you have the bones of all 3 individuals. I have the bones of 2. Whatever the amount was, and we give them to the shaman, and then he shows them to the supernatural gamekeeper, and then he will place them in the crevice
shrine.
And so Linda Brown and Kitty Emery have gotten permission from the Lake Atitlan to go through that entire cache of bones. And some of them are several meters thick. I mean, it's amazing. And they noticed a very disturbing trend that the deer get younger and younger. The average age of deer being taken gets younger and younger and younger.
Wow.
That's not sustainable. That's very problematic. It means that you don't want to pick off young juveniles. You want to let them live and reproduce. So that's a sign of stress, population stress. And this is when they both went and talked to the Lake Atitlan Maya, who they absolutely have the utmost respect and they really love the Lake Atitlan Maya. You can sense it just from talking with them. And they brought them, they put them together in a meeting and in a very respectful and non-accusatory way. They didn't say like, hey, you guys, no. They said, we're very concerned because if this trend continues, you're going to run out of deer. And that's when they kind of
woke up.
Got
their attention.
But instead of saying, oh my gosh, they thought that was, they actually laughed. They said, that's impossible. Because what determines success is not skill or anything like that, it's supernatural gamekeepers. And we're doing everything we're supposed to do. We're only staying with them. And so this is a big problem. And do you see how this whole belief of supernatural gamekeepers is part of what's called traditional ecological knowledge, right? TEK. And, the fact that the supernatural gamekeepers are putting limits on prey harvesting, that will foment sustainable harvest. I will fully acknowledge that. So the presence of a belief in supernatural gamekeepers, i.e. a form of TEK, is conducive to sustainable harvest. Absolutely. However, and this is what my research has shown, and this is what David Dye has shown, that once the Western world comes in, the presence, the maintenance, the adherence to TEK can actually foster non-sustainable harvest.
With that, let's move on to the next segment. See you in the flip-flop, gang. Welcome back, gang. This is third and final segment for your episode 129 of your Rock Art podcast. We're here today talking about supernatural gamekeepers with Dr. Rick Chacon. And during the last segment, we were talking about some of the confounding issues regarding resource depression, dealing with perhaps over-hunting, and somehow understanding what the explanatory platform would be to sort of wrap our minds around that. And Rick, you were saying there's a bit of a controversy surrounding all of this. Am I correct?
Yes. And for example, Native peoples are supposed to be quintessential stewards of nature. And people will say, well, why would Native peoples deplete the beaver harvests that we know happened during the fur trade? And why did Native people say of the Southeast of North America just devastate the local white-tailed deer population, which that was done by the Native people? Well, there's research out there. One, a guy named Calvin Martin, put forth this notion that the reason why Native peoples over-harvest natural resources, be they beaver or white-tailed deer, well, he said there's two reasons, but mainly they took up Christianity, which basically means they apostatized. That was his words. They apostatized. They gave up their traditional beliefs, and I would say they lost their TEK. That's how I would put it. And many people run with that, but the problem is there's a much more parsimonious explanation. All of those people, whether they be beaver trappers or Southeastern Indians, are operating with the supernatural gamekeeper concept. And that means if I keep my part of the deal, wildlife will it's guaranteed. And what's the deal? Take only what you need and be respectful of the carcass. That's it. That's all you have to do. Well, if you are a Native person, say in the Southeast, say in the 1700s, it says take only what you need, right?
Right.
Guess what? But 1700s, you need a gun. You need a firearm. Why?
Right.
The Iroquois are coming down and they are just ravaging communities. You better have a gun or you'll end up dead or enslaved. It's just not pretty. So your needs have changed. But you need a gun. It's not you're not playing. So that means now that you have to harvest more deer, more than just for subsistence. You need deer to get a gun because you want to stay alive or stay free. So, but you're keeping your part of the bargain. You're only taking what you need, but the number of deer that which is needed now has grown exponentially, because where do you get guns? You get it, you trade it from whites. And at this time, you're talking about British. So you see how the needs increase, the needs change, but the native peoples are operating within their framework. In other words, they can look themselves in the mirror and say, we've not violated any our part of the supernatural contract.
Right.
Only taking our needs, and we're disposing of the bones properly. Everything should be fine.
Correct. That's the same way that our colleague talked about the Torres Strait and the dugong.
Ah, yes, exactly. But the point here is, it was adherence to the TEK of the group.
Yeah, it's adherence to their indigenous cosmology.
Exactly.
It has to do with their expectations and their traditions. Now, archaeologically, for instance, in the Kosos and elsewhere, there are, you know, quite compelling examples of what we feel to be resource depression or the over exploitation of large game.
Yeah, I mean,
and that's been in the Southwest, that's been in Eastern California. And if there's a relationship to that phenomenon and the indigenous activities, ceremonial activities relating to the need to increase them and ask for the favor because they felt they were falling out of favor, perhaps, with the supernatural gamekeeper. Wouldn't that be correct?
It's a very plausible scenario. And I want to jump on what you just said. That
please.
And this is true. This is true for not only the example that you mentioned, but I'd like to go back to the dugong of Torres Strait that Shelley Tilley, formerly last name was Raven. Boy, her dissertation is unbelievable. In that, as dugongs, these giant sea cows, these giant manatees, are extremely difficult to capture. Extremely difficult to capture. And so only a handful of men have the knowledge and the courage to take these things. And it's not that they're going to get into a fight with the dugong, but to spear a dugong, you have to basically almost jump on it. And like with your whole body weight, you got to slam the spear in. And that's when you have the great potential of getting your feet tangled up in the cord, because the spears are tied or tethered. And so only the most courageous men will bring these dugongs. And as dugongs become rarer, the scarcity is attributed to failure on the part of hunters to follow certain proper rituals. There was a place where you should display the skulls of dugongs because there's a supernatural gamekeeper, the dugong.
Our shamans are not as powerful as they used to be.
Yes.
We don't have as many of them.
And young people are not acting as properly. And so all
right,
of these things
right.
are supernatural causes for the dugongs to decline. But this is what's really important. As these high-ranked prey species decline, when somebody kills them, their status goes through the roof.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what happens is then guys are interested in, climbing the social ladder, especially
of
young
course.
Guys.
Yeah.
So even if they may end up wasting more energy in capturing a particular species, it may be worth it because of the payoffs, the status payoffs. It might even have reproductive payoffs. So even though from a caloric standpoint, it's been not a best strategy, they may have expended more calories in bringing this animal home. But, when they do show up, since it's such a rare animal and since it's such a highly prized animal like the dugong, They're greeted almost like with a ticker tape parade, like they
right.
are
it's,
just heroes. And so it more than makes up for the energy net loss for them.
And that would also encompass political power, influence, in terms of accessing certain, elements of their culture, and also attracting the most prestigious and beautiful brides that would be available within their group.
Which is
not so different from our current culture with the politics and power and etc.
Status is an aphrodisiac.
Right.
And so, but see, then the quest for status will put pressure on species that are already stressed out. And so you can see how status hunting can be conducive to depletion.
Which may have been as true in pre-contact times as it was in the ethnographic present and in terms of the documentation of indigenous cultures today. So what we trying to do is figure out some way to accommodate those precarious nature of living with that kind of cosmological nexus, right?
Yeah, and one of the things, I'm not a development anthropologist, but if I was, I'd be really concerned about these young males who are wanting to go up the social ladder, but the traditional means of doing it was, you know, become a great warrior, become a great right. shaman, become a great trader, somebody who brings in objects that are not available locally, become a great hunter. But when those options are no longer viable, in that, you know, warfare your group is pacified, warfare is no longer allowed, and your hunting choices are getting tougher and tougher, what's a young man to do? So I think in those cases, development workers should really work at providing alternative pathways by which males can move
for recognition that
are not destructive to the environment, because, you know, they're going to want to move up. So we have to come up with ways, alternative pathways, in which they can feel good about themselves, where they can grow and develop their talents in ways that don't deplete the environment.
That would have positive economic implications.
Exactly. And that they, you know, it's a win-win situation. They get the status that's desired, and the community gets the benefits from their efforts, because, you know, these are young guys, they're smart guys, they have a lot of energy. We want it to be used in ways that benefit not just them, but the entire group.
So the issues we're dealing with, though, are cultural longevity and sustainability.
Sustainability is key. I want Native peoples to be around forever. And for that to happen, permit me to get on my soapbox for a moment.
Please.
If we want Native peoples to be around, and I that's my goal number one, the most important thing to do is eschew the romantic notions that they are innate conservationists.
Right.
It's not going to help in any way. That may make people feel good at home, but it's going to do absolutely no good for people that are dealing with reality. And by reality, I mean they have a limited land base, their numbers are growing, the local wildlife population is not growing exponentially. That's a demographic time bomb that's going to hit. And so I like to deal in reality, and so I want to help them come up with real-world solutions in the now to deal with that. And for example, among the Embera of Colombia, they're in this place called Utria National Park. And the national park people there really saw that they were going for this demographic train wreck, because they also were, you know, causing food, wildlife depletion. So they put together a potential long-term plan that involved no kill zones. In other words, the whole hunting territory was sort of divided.
Okay.
Here's a no kill zone, but let's rotate this. And so that was something that was proposed. And like that is something that is not that hard to start. But whatever you do, and this is key, it must be community-based. It cannot be imposed from outside. That Native stakeholders have to be brought in, and they need to be consulted at every stage so that it's their solution, not some solution being imposed by outsiders. Because if you do that, that's doomed to failure. Plus, it's very unethical.
So you have to bring in the stakeholders.
Yes, and you bring in the shamans. You bring in the shamans. And that's what the folks at Utria National Park did. They actually brought in the shamans because, you know, these shamans have tremendous status in the community. And then the shamans were playing a role in deciding what areas would be the no-kill zones and all that. So those are the kinds of things that can be done that shows great respect for the culture, that shows of the community-based, because that's the key to success The Native peoples have to be part. They need to be consulted at every stage. Nothing should be imposed. And then hopefully you hope for the best, but you want to avoid what's known. You don't want to create what's known as conservation refugees. Dawi in 2009 wrote about this, and it's the dark secret of conservation. I'm a conservationist, but there's some conservationists that believe the way you preserve wildlife is by kicking out all the people that are within striking distance of the species that's vulnerable. And the problem when you do that is, well, what about the native groups? That's their homeland that you're talking about.
Right, of course.
You know, like I say, I'm for biodiversity. I'm for the preservation of wildlife. Absolutely. But I'm also pro-human rights.
So, you know, if you're killing the golden goose, right?
Yeah.
And you're saving the animals. What good is it?
Yeah, and like I so get it in that, you know, I so want for there to be high biodiversity, absolutely. But when you kick native peoples out, you're trying to do a very good thing, but in a very bad way. And there are much better ways of doing it. And there's lots of success stories out there of native peoples not being kicked out, not turned into conservation refugees, to use Dawi's term, but rather they are embraced by the park people and they are part of the solution. And that's what's happening now among the dugong hunters that Shelley Tilley writes about. They're now, because think about this, a native group, native hunters, they know that territory like the backs of their hands. I mean, they grew up there. They know the area, they know the animals, wildlife. Who better than to be a park ranger?
Absolutely. And I think with that thought, we shall say a fond adieu.
Oh, okay. I hope to take this up at a future date, because I had fun.
Well, you talked about a possibility of a part two, and that's still on the table. Thank you, listeners, and thank you to Dr. Rick Chacon for a fabulously interesting podcast.
Thanks for the invitation. It's been an honor.
God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.